Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee. We have a full agenda today, so we'll try to move through it as expeditiously as possible. We're going to start out to sort of clear the decks with some introduction of bills. We have quite a stack today because it's the last day for bill introduction. I'd remind the committee that you should have received an email. We won't adjourn when we're done with our meeting today. We'll recess. There's a small possibility that there may still be a couple of more committee bills near the 4:30 time frame where the committee may need to reconvene to get at least a quorum for purposes of final bill introduction. If that's necessary, we'll contact your offices and do what we can to try to round people up for about 5 minutes. If it's not, don't worry about it. If you don't hear from the committee staff, you can assume that it wasn't necessary, and I'll come in later this afternoon and do a final adjournment of the committee if we don't need additional time for bill introduction. With that, you've got a stack of LCs in front of you. I'm going to go quickly and just read the relating clauses and then just ask for a motion, your support on a motion to introduce the bills as committee bills. First is LC 344, relating to functions of the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission and declaring an emergency. LC 345, relating to activities regulated by the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission. LC 364, relating to the Department of Justice. LC 365, relating to death. LC 1414, relating to water rights and declaring an emergency. LC 1464, relating to patient access to health information. LC 1492, relating to small claims. LC 1500, relating to public safety officers. LC 1620, relating to public official ethics. LC 1717, relating to court reporters and declaring an emergency. LC 1766, relating to the ability to seek review of agency actions. LC 2288, relating to to consent to adoption. LC 2515, relating to livestock. LC 2525, relating to civil actions. LC 2529, relating to programs established by the Board of Medical Examiners for State of Oregon for certain medical professionals. LC 2617, relating to land use in exclusive farm use zones. LC 2784, relating to local corrections. LC 2845, relating to unclaimed property. LC 2894, relating to courts. LC 2922, relating to recording of orders, assessing civil penalties. LC 2954, relating to costs in criminal proceedings. LC 2955, relating to community corrections. LC 2960, relating to corrections. LC 2957, relating to collection of delinquent accounts for counties. LC 2961, relating to notaries. LC 2999, relating to public official ethics. LC 3001, relating to public official ethics. LC 3020, relating to energy facility siting. LC 3068, relating to damages. LC 3090, relating to crime. LC 3091, relating to sentencing, declaring an emergency and providing for criminal sentence reduction that requires approval by two-thirds majority. LC 3092, relating to death penalty and declaring an emergency. LC 3136, relating to incarceration, declaring an emergency and providing for criminal sentence reduction that requires approval by two-thirds majority. LC 3137, relating to corrections. LC 3168, relating to persons licensed by Board of Medical Examiners and declaring an emergency. LC 3169, relating to medical services lien and declaring an emergency. LC 3231, relating to drug court programs. LC 3244, relating to personal injury protection benefits. LC 3282, relating to...
This is actually revenue play.
Yeah, there you go. That's why we have a dentist on the committee. The Deoxyribonucleic acid testing. Thank you, Representative. LC 3294, relating to statute of frauds. LC 3362, relating to child custody. LC 3387, relating to public contracting. LC 3418, relating to picketing. LC 3455, relating to consolidation of laws governing eminent domain. LC 3456, relating to initial offers in eminent domain proceedings. And LC 3457 relating to pre-condemnation access to land. Those are the LCs we have currently in front of us. The chair would move that all those bills be introduced as committee bills. As usual, no indication by the committee by its introduction by any member of either support or opposition to the bills. Is there any discussion on the motion? Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking forward to the first reading day when OB gets to the bill relating to deoxyribonucleic acid.
Yeah,
at the pace that he reads the relatings clause.
Yeah, me too.
Watch. And the fiduciary stopped him up once.
Okay, we'll go ahead, and if there's no objection on the motion, then those bills are introduced as committee bills. Mr. Taylor's going to take another run through because he's got two other drafts that he doesn't think that I read, and if he finds them in there, then we'll go ahead and do another couple of bills. And again, we'll come back together if we need to, if there's some other bills that come to the committee between now and 4:30, and we'll do another brief measure introduction if we need to at that time. So, that being done, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2422. And want to invite forward Gary Pello, who is the legislative assistant for Representative Backlund. Hi, Gary.
Chair Williams and committee members, my name is Gary Pello. I am legislative assistant for Representative Backlund. He wanted to be here this afternoon, but as you might know, he is chairing a critical meeting of the House Education Committee at this time. Representative Backlund is the chief sponsor of House Bill 2422 and would urge the committee to support this bill. It is his understanding that there have been violations of school crossings and that there is a need to do what House Bill 2422 calls for and to prosecute those who violate the school crossings when crossing guards are present. Drivers are accustomed to stopping when school buses are stopped and red lights are flashing. No less should be expected when crossing guards are present in the crossing in a designated school zone. This is truly a safety issue. And there are a couple of other witnesses here today who have worked as crossing guards and will tell you some of the details and some of the experiences that they have had. So with that, I thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Gary. Are there any questions for Gary before we bring up the other witnesses? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, what are the penalties for Class A traffic violation, basically?
Council?
We have a general idea.
It's a fine. I'll have to go to a
small fine. Okay.
Yeah, right.
I think it's six.
Representative Barker, do you remember when you were driving
the
patrol?
Class A is a fairly substantial fine, but it could be. It's a judge's discretion on that.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Shetterly.
As I was reading through my bills yesterday, This just got us into a good discussion at home. My daughter is on crossing guard duty this morning at her grade school, so I got to get her input and opinion on this bill, and she thinks it's a great one. So
that's good to know. Anything else for Gary? Thank you, Gary. We'll now ask Judy Smith and Deborah Latham if they would both come forward. Welcome. If you just want to go ahead and be sure to put your name and information on the record.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Williams and committee members. My name is Judy Smith. I am from the city of Kaiser in Marion County.
And hi, I'm Deborah Latham, and I am a crossing guard with the Whitaker Middle School in Kaiser.
I'm here today to appeal to you for the protection of school crossing guards. I was a crossing guard for the Salem-Kaiser School District for almost 5 years. During this time, I feared for the students' lives as well as my own on many occasions. One of the problems that I frequently ran into was vehicles being allowed to enter the crosswalk while I was still standing in it. ORS 811.015, failure to obey a traffic patrol member, the penalty. Number one, the driver of the vehicle commits the offense of failure to obey a traffic patrol member if, and subsection B, the driver does not stop and yield the right of way to students who are in or entering the crosswalk from either direction on the street on which the driver is operating. If a vehicle does not stop or yield for students, said driver has committed a Class A traffic violation. But if the driver does not stop or yield for the crossing guard, there is no violation. In my experience, I can be standing out in the crosswalk with my flag out, and as soon as the students have reached the sidewalk, the cars start to pass me on both sides, making it almost impossible for me to get back to my station on the sidewalk. There have been times I may have stood out in the crosswalk for a few seconds after the students have reached the sidewalk, because in my experience, a student will turn around and want to run back home because of a forgotten backpack, a lunch, a project, or a pair of shoes because they're wearing rollerblades. If the cars are allowed to pass me and a student turns around and darts back into the crosswalk, there is a great possibility for an accident. Also, I have almost been hit on many occasions when traffic starts going around me, impatient to get where they are going. There has also been many instances when cars have stopped and drivers have screamed obscenities out of their windows at me for being in their way. The problem with ORS 811.015 came to my attention when an officer ticketed one of the vehicles for entering the crosswalk while I was still out there. The judge had no option other than to find the driver not guilty due to the ORS only covering students. In talking with the City of Keyser Police Traffic Unit, I discovered that this has happened many times before, and due to the interpretation of the judge, other cases have been thrown out. I'm here today to plead for the safety of crossing guards all over the state of Oregon. It's not an easy job we do, and we would greatly appreciate any help to keep us safe as we try to protect the many students we serve daily. This can be accomplished by amending ORS 811.015 to include drivers stopping and yielding to traffic patrol members, as well as students in crosswalks. I want to thank you for your time and consideration in this matter that is of utmost importance. And I would also like to state I would like to thank Representative Backlund and his office for helping us with this.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. If you'd please stay at the table, we'll allow Ms. Latham to testify, and then we'll have questions.
You can tell that I work for a school. I come with poster board in hand. At Whitaker Middle School, I'm actually at the busiest intersection where we have students cross. And I'm on the corner here. This is Lock Haven coming this way, 14th this way. In the mornings, when I go out to have students cross from this side, and I am out here halfway, I have many cars that will come and turn behind me, and the students haven't reached me yet, or the students could be behind me. That is one way that we certainly have a problem. Another way is when traffic is coming here, and as soon as the students, if they're barely out of the way, they will certainly try to come through, and it's definitely not safe. I've actually had cars hit the end of my pole because they're that close to the students just getting to me. I also have the problem with the students being over here. A lot of times there's a traffic signal. A lot of times the cars will go ahead and turn right before the student even steps off the curb. So I am very much in favor of this bill because it's extremely dangerous with the situation we have now, and there's not much we can do about it until this is passed.
Thank you very much, Ms. Latham. Is there any questions for either of these two witnesses?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Andrews.
Thank you. I can understand, and I certainly appreciate the problem. Is there any provision for this being an experimental for a short time to bring people up to understanding? If we're talking a multi-$100 fine, it would seem like it'd be good to kind of educate the public in some way before we implement this. Had you thought?
Actually, I don't feel that it's a new concept or a new idea, okay, in that they've already got a stop for students, and there's also a ORS to protect pedestrians. So this should not come as a surprise, you know, that we should be covered also. It would be, to my thought, the discretion of maybe the judge or the local police departments.
That's good. I will point out to the committee, Mr. Taylor showed me the statute, which indicates that the Class A offense is a $600 fine. I don't think it would take very many of those before people would figure out that it was pretty significant. Any other questions for either of the two witnesses? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you sharing with us your personal experiences. I'm not sure I'd want to stand out in the middle of traffic at rush hour in the morning with my sort of flag and pole as the only thing to protect me. Will anybody else here to testify on House Bill 2422? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2422, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2422. What's the committee's pleasure?
Chair.
Representative Jensen?
I move House Bill 2422 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Jensen moves House Bill 2422 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on his motion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Crummell.
Thank you. The only part of the bill that I'm, that, and I guess this is, this might be a little session of record building for legislative intent, but on line 7, it at the end of line 7, it says, or are about to enter the crosswalk. One of the complaints that I hear from constituents with regards to pedestrians in crosswalks and crossing patrol members and that sort of thing is the interpretation that the police put on the term or are about to enter. I don't know that there's necessarily any other way of putting it, but I would certainly hope that that this does not end up being interpreted as they're 45 feet from the crosswalk, but they might occasionally, or they might be on their way, and so a driver is unnecessarily cited for violation of the statute. I just want to make clear what actually or about to enter actually means. I'll support the bill. I think it's a good idea, and I think you're right. I think a couple of these types of fines, and people will realize that we're real serious about when pedestrians are in crosswalks. But it's just something that I would like to make sure that our police forces are fairly consistent in how they administer. Thank you.
Fair comments. Thank you, Representative. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To my good colleague. That talks about failure to stop after the patrol member is in the walkway waiting for the children to arrive. So the patrol person is out in the crosswalk already, and so that would take care of your concerns about it. It's not like some kids walking down the street and you'd give somebody a ticket for not stopping. It's when the flag person is already out in the crosswalk, allowing the children to enter.
Thank you.
Any other discussion by the committee?
Mr. Chair,
yes, Representative McPherson.
Just to offer up a comment here, I see this bill as being a one step in aid of a sort of a general effort that I think we need to pursue on a broad front, which is to try to make our roadways safer for school children to get to school. I've encountered in my district many families who will drive their children to school, even fairly short distances from their homes, because of the concern about safety and being able to walk to the schoolhouse. And so I strongly support this bill and any effort that will make our roadways safer to get to school.
Thank you, Representative. Anything else? Well, given our, as Representative Shetterly pointed out, our earlier floor session today, my temptation would be to see if we need a floor count down in the House floor to see if they'd actually support a bill for crosswalks for kids. But with that being said, Representative Jensen's motion is to move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Ann, why don't you call the roll?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative
Brzezinski? Excused.
Representative
Shetterly? Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2422 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
No, I want to let Representative McPherson redeem himself from
I should be able to recover from the wounds I suffered earlier today.
His earlier bill carry today, so this bill will be assigned to Representative McPherson. And you better make sure Representative Barker is on board with you before you get on the floor. Okay, we are briefly now going to move into work session on House Bill 2099. This should just take a moment, as I recall. Council, can you bring us up to speed?
Chair, members of the committee, this bill was last before you back in January, and it requires attorneys who have filed an antitrust class action on behalf of a natural person to give within 30 days of the complaint the Attorney General written notice of the action and a copy of the complaint. It requires the attorney for natural persons in a class action suit brought under the Oregon antitrust provisions to notify the Attorney General in writing the proposed settlement, provide a copy of the proposed settlement. This was the product of an extensive work group during the interim session, which I believe you and Senator Menendez participated in. And Andy Obertine is in the audience if you have any questions. No amendments.
No amendments. And Andy, do you want to come forward just a minute? Yeah, you can come too, Cheryl. It's been a long time, believe it or not, since the committee probably remembers having the hearing where we originally discussed this bill. Is there anything? What was the? Can you help remind us why we waited to move the bill at that time if we're not looking at amendments?
Mr. Chair, I believe we were awaiting the final approval and submission of the report.
That's
from the Illinois BRIC
right.
Committee. Mr. Albertine has just provided final copies of the report with a cover memo to the committee.
Right. And I did receive on the 24th of February a final copy of the Illinois BRIC report from that committee from the Attorney General's office. And I think we did have a few minor recommendations to the committee for inclusion in the report. Is that right, Mr. Albertine?
That's correct, Chair Williams. One of the recommendations was to include the reasoning why there weren't any sanctions or penalties for failure to comply with the bill. And we put some rationale in there in the report to address
and
that.
And my recollection is that the work group was unanimous in support of the current version of the bill. Is that right? So there was no opposition to House Bill 2099 as it's currently drafted.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, that is correct.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So is all of this coming back to committee members from our earlier discussion? If it's not, I strongly encourage you to read the very dense report on amending the Oregon Antitrust Act to expand indirect purchaser monetary remedies. If this is the bill that we discussed previously, I think Mr. Gardner also testified at the time Mr. Albertine testified from the business side of the work group. Any questions? All right, then thank you both. We are in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
House Bill 2099 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2099 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll call the roll. Ann.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Cromwell?
Aye.
Representative
McPherson? Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2099 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any volunteers? All right, I'll carry it. It'll be a fascinating floor speech, I can assure you. All right, we are now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2425. Council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2425 is exempt from disclosure under the public records laws certain information relating to public safety and proposes to, as far as open meetings laws, limit the open meetings laws where public safety issues involved. This all comes from the task force that we had during the interim session as it relates to a response from the governor's office and the attorney general's office as of a gap analysis of our laws after September 11th.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. I'm going to start out with Keith Cutler from the Department of Justice as our first witness.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Keith Cutler with the Department of Justice. As Mr. Taylor has described, House Bill 2425 is an outgrowth, a product of the gap analysis undertaken by the Department of Justice after the events of September 11th, 2001. This particular item is related to disclosure of information that may be in the hands of a public body, that may be sensitive information that probably has always would have been a concern had it been released to the public, but the concerns heightened following September 11th, 2001. The idea behind this concept was to identify in as narrow a fashion as possible security-sensitive information that should be protected from public disclosure. I will add that in the immediate aftermath of September 11, 2001, a number of states acted very quickly with this same concept in mind. And those states who acted very quickly, I think, also acted very broadly, and perhaps too broadly. We've had an opportunity for reflection. We've had an opportunity for a task force to get together. We've had an opportunity for input from many different perspectives. And that is reflected in what is House Bill 2425. The bill essentially does two things. It broadens some existing exemptions that applied only to public bodies or information contained in public bodies or that protected only individuals who are members of public bodies, and broadens those to any person or any information that happens to be in the hand of a public body. It also adds an exemption for security plans, particularly of utilities that may be shared with their regulators. And when I say utilities, I use that in a very broad sense to include things like water, sewer, not just those kinds of utilities that are regulated by our Public Utility Commission. The printed bill that you have before you represents much of the thinking of this task force. However, we continued to meet and refine our thinking as time went by, even after the bill was submitted to Legislative Council. And for that reason, we have worked together. We've come up with some amendments that we would like to propose. I know you have a copy of a hand-engrossed version of the bill in front of you. It obviously is not quite ready for your work on it yet. And at the end of the day, what I hope you will do is authorize me or the task force in general to work with Legislative Council to ensure that we're getting exactly the product that we intend to get here. If I may, I'll give you a quick rundown of the printed bill and also what the differences are in the amendments. If I'm getting too long-winded, I'll just count on you to cut me off. The printed bill makes three changes to ORS 192.501. That's the exemption from public records that is conditional. That is, there has to be a balancing test. The first change is in subsection 18. It expands that exemption to, as I said previously, to apply to any public body. The second change is in subsection 22 of the same statute. That change actually only eliminates or deletes some language to accomplish the same goal. Subsection 23 pertains to security measures. This change expands the applicability of the exemption in two ways. First of all, it's not just the measures themselves, but also recommendations or limitations involving them. And again, also to any building or property and person, not only public buildings and property and public body employees. There's one addition to ORS 192.502. That's the unconditional exemptions. That is, if the material fits the exemption, then it would be exempt from disclosure without a balancing test. This is the utility-related information I described earlier. The printed bill has in addition to ORS 192.690, that's contained within the public meetings law, and 192.690 describes those meetings of a public governing body of a public body that, but for the fact they're listed in that statute, would be subject to the public meetings law. Our original concept was to exclude from the public meetings law these discussions by, say, the Public Utility Commission or public utility district that had anything to do with the security plans and information related to those utilities. In further discussion on that, we think that may be going little further than we need to go, and instead, as you'll see later, we're recommending that those kinds of discussions occur in an executive session rather than outside of the public meetings law. There are also some other changes to 192.690 in the nature of housekeeping that were drafted by legislative counsel. Now, just to bring you up to date to what we're doing with the proposed amendments, this is also described and outlined in my draft written testimony that you have. We propose two changes in the amendment to ORS 192.501 sub 23. That's the security measures. In part, what we're asking be done is that the language that's in the bill actually be returned to language that we had in our original draft that we submitted to legislative council. Now, this raises kind of an interesting issue for me, which is if legislative council was drafting what we had asked them to draft but used different words, did they really draft something different or not? And for that reason, my request to you will be to give us, as I mentioned earlier, some authorization to work with legislative council. It may be that the language in the printed bill is exactly what we're after. The task force looking at it following the printing of the bill believed that the different language used by legislative council changed our meaning, and so we've moved it back to what it was before. And both of the changes referenced to that section on page 2 of the written testimony are in that vein. In the amendment to RS 192.502, the new exemption for the utility-related material, there are a couple of technical changes we'd like made. One is to remove the reference to in liquid form to hazardous substances. This is an instance where legislative counsel drafted exactly what we asked him to draft. Unfortunately, isn't exactly what we were thinking. So we think that should be covering all hazardous substances, that is, security plans related to hazardous substances, and not just those in liquid form. Also, the reference to communications devices in that printing refers to a statute in the tax statutes rather than giving its own definition. My original concept and what you see in the hand-engrossed bill is a change that incorporates the language of that tax statute. It has been brought to my attention that that may not be broad enough. In fact, what we had drafted as a task force for this exemption, we plagiarized from a statute in the utility arena having to do with the one-call centers. That is, you know, the statutes that describe the entity that you call when you're digging in your driveway. And that statute describes in pretty good detail all kinds of the things that are buried under the ground or could be buried under the ground that you could be hitting. Among the things that you can be hitting with respect to with communications are wires that have to do with wireless communications, believe it or not, also certainly cable, and data communications. We want to make sure that this reference to communications encompasses all of that. Again, legislative counsel may think that the definition that is referenced does that. We just want to be sure, and that's one of the changes we'd like to make. And then finally, as I mentioned earlier, in 192.690, we no longer believe we need the exception from the public meetings law for the utility-related items. That is appropriate to put that into the executive session area. And having done all that, there will be some other minor technical changes to the bill as well. So that's it in a nutshell. As you can see, it's a simple bill. And I'd be happy to address any questions that you have about it now or at any time during the afternoon or at any other time.
Are there questions, Mr. Cutler? We've got a number of witnesses, so we may wish to have him stand by and respond later. But if committee has questions now, Representative Shetterly?
Nope.
Do you have a question?
Nope.
Okay. I thought I saw your pen. All right. Thank you, Keith. If you
thank
just
you.
Want to stand by. Ms. Meyer?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU. First, my apologies. I have to leave at 2, and it's not for a lack of interest, but a commitment elsewhere. So I will speak briefly and will, of course, be quite interested in hearing about the conversation that you have today. The ACLU of Oregon obviously is concerned about the need that, as much as possible, records may be maintained in the public, consistent with the philosophy and policy around the public records and open meeting laws. With that said, we have been working as part of, I guess, the task force. I sort of like that more official name than work group. I can say that we are more comfortable with the proposed amendments that Keith Cutler just walked you through than the original bill. One of the things I always worry about is the language. And we've worked very hard and talked a lot, but maybe you need to continue those conversations about the language that we pick in terms of security measures and those things that that we don't sweep in too broadly, things that we don't want to be excluded. One of the things, you know, when we talk about security, one of the things that we always look at is making sure, you know, the public knows, the media is the eyes and ears to ensure that government is actually taking the right steps to ensure that there is security measures, that there isn't, that things aren't falling through the crack, that there's not a entity that's sitting there hearing that there's absolutely inadequate security and no one knows about that, the public doesn't know, the public can't call out and demand that there in fact be a better security taken. So it's that balancing the need for the public to know through the eyes and ears mostly of the media to ensure that we all and our government is doing its job. We are far more comfortable with the documents that will be in the exempt from public record, the 502, with the now required, the balancing of that being that any discussion of those things occur in executive session rather than be exempt entirely from any discussion, because then, again, and I'm sure you will hear this from folks representing the media, they can be there to be the eyes and ears. So with that said, I'd be happy to answer any questions and look forward to working on this some more.
Are there questions for Ms. Meyer? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to bring up Kenneth Murphy, Gregory Williford, and Wayne McFarland. Have you worked out among the three of you who wants to go first?
I'll just jump right in there.
Feel free.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Deputy Director of Oregon Emergency Management, and I just wanted to put forth my support of this bill. I have not worked on the task force, but have been on the peripheral edges of dealing with it with different members of the law enforcement community and so forth, and Mr. Cutler as well. And just try and bring the relevance and the importance of dealing with security of critical infrastructure or other items that we as citizens and communities rely upon, and also in our agency and what we do to try and bring these issues together. When we look at the overall emergency preparedness for the state, a lot of times we cannot put some of those plans together because of public meetings, and when we actually try and combine different utilities to determine our priorities to deal with them if there is an emergency, and working with the law enforcement community. So I just wanted to emphasize the importance of this, and I'm sure my colleagues here will continue that, especially on critical infrastructure. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Members will go through the panel and then open it to questions. Mr. Williford?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Greg Williford. I'm the commander of the Oregon State Police Bureau of Investigation. One of the duties I have is to oversee the Office of Public Safety and Security, which is in the Department of State Police. That office was created shortly after the tragic events of September 11th. One of the primary missions of that office is to support counterterrorism efforts as led by the FBI and the Joint Terrorism Task Force out of the Portland Division, and also assist others, Oregon Emergency Management and others, in the statewide domestic preparedness efforts that are occurring prior to September 11th and certainly in earnest relative to terrorism events after that. As part of our efforts statewide in domestic preparedness, after the events of September, state police, local public safety agencies, emergency management, and many other people, both public and private, are involved in mapping out and assessing critical infrastructure and assets, key assets in the state of Oregon, to assure that the security of those infrastructures and assets is fulfilled, and that there aren't any significant gaps that could cause problems for safety and security in the state. There is an enormous number of what we call sectors out in the state of critical infrastructure and assets. They range anywhere from the security plans for transportation of nuclear waste material to hazardous materials to our transportation system to government emergency operations centers to bio research labs, and the list goes on and on and on as far as what you would designate as critical infrastructure in the state. Not to mention the public utility issues of the power grid, the natural gas pipelines, the telephone wireless structure that's in the state, that is also indeed critical infrastructure that we need to assure and work with the people that are responsible for protecting those systems to make sure they have security plans in place. In the post-September 11th world in which we operate in today, we know that terrorist elements are inside our borders, and that they can attack us inside the borders of the United States. The threat of an additional attack in this country is real. We know also that we have certain vulnerabilities in Oregon, and some of those vulnerabilities involve our critical infrastructure. It's imperative that we have the ability to work very fluidly and cooperatively with those entities and individuals that are responsible for various critical infrastructure in the state of Oregon, whether it's a government agency or it's a private industry. A lot of critical infrastructure is private. And those discussions very well may be documented and become part of the public record, and it may be difficult for some of those entities to want to sit down and really talk to us about their security plans so that we can get an assurance that those vulnerabilities or security plans are certainly in place to reduce the risk of problems. Passage of House Bill 2425 would certainly serve to protect the sensitive security information from inappropriate disclosure and would enhance the communication, we believe, between public organizations and those entities that represent critical infrastructure. Therefore, we would support the bill and further debate on that issue to enhance the ability for us to assure that the most vulnerable critical infrastructure is indeed protected. With that, I'll conclude my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wolford. Chief McFarland.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Wayne McFarland, Chief of Police in McMinnville Police Department, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police to speak in favor of House Bill 2425. Since September 11, 2001, the mission of public safety has changed dramatically for local law enforcement. We must now devote a greater proportion of our resources to preserving the integrity of such essential services as our water supplies and utilities. And we must also develop an increased ability to address potential threats to our citizens at gathering points such as schools, sporting events, malls, and the like. Ensuring that our effort to maintain our public's safety in the face of potential terrorist threat is a critical need for us, and this challenge is exacerbated by budget decreases that are felt at all levels of government throughout the state. House Bill 2425 creates limited disclosure exemptions to Oregon's public records law in matters related to security. This is an important bill that allows our government to more effectively secure these essential resources and maintain public safety. The Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police supports the passage of House Bill 2425.
Thank you, Chief. Are there questions for this panel? We're letting you off easy, gentlemen, today. Must be, well, okay, good. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next, Christy Monson from the League of Oregon Cities, Candace Haynes, City Attorney with the City of McMinnville, and Tom O'Connor, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities.
Uh, Hi, Welcome. Chair Williams, members of the committee. My name is Christy Munson. I represent the League of Oregon Cities, which is an association of 238 cities throughout the state of Oregon. With me today is the city attorney of McMinnville, Candace Haynes, and Tom O'Connor representing Municipal Electric Utilities Association. We'll be short. Most of the points have already been touched upon. I just wanted to quickly tell you that we're very proud that this bill, although yet unfinished, we're almost there, is the product of a collaborative work group containing members from the ACLU, the Newspapers Association, and local governments. We were very much aware that this is a touchy issue, and we wanted to maintain respect for open government and civil rights, and yet still protect our citizens. And we believe we are very close to a product that does just that. The League would like, first and foremost, to express its full support and admiration for Oregon's open government laws. We work to train our cities to respect those laws and to disclose information whenever possible. You've heard briefly what this bill does. I'll be concise. What the bill does is extend three already existing exemptions in the public records law, and that those exemptions are in Section 501. Section 501, you should know, is already subject to some overarching protections, the first of which is that the presumption against is that the government should always disclose. So if a court is, if it's going to be challenged, the court will always say, you know, the presumption is for disclosure. In Oregon, we respect open government that much. Additionally, the burden to prove that you qualify for exemption is always going to be on the government. So those three extensions of the exemptions are already subject to that overall public interest balancing test, with the burden being on the government. 502 does not have that balancing test. That is pertains only to utilities and telecommunications. Lastly, people have expressed concern about executive sessions. We want you to know that everything that has been changed in this bill will be subject to the executive sessions provision of the open government law. That means that media can still perform their watchdog functions. So if, by chance, a city or another government is not doing what it should, it does not have an adequate safety plan, the media will be able to sit on an executive sessions and find out information, and we think that's important too. I'd like to turn the testimony over to Candace Haynes, city attorney. She is a city person on the ground running with these laws and has had experience with how the lack of having these kind of exemptions has affected the city of McMinnville in the past.
Ms. Haynes, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chair Williams, members of the committee. I am Candace Haynes. I'm the city attorney for McMinnville. And I'm here today to tell you a little bit about my experience with this. I've been at the kind of law that I practice for a lot longer than I want to confess to any of you. And long ago, and in another job, I did have an experience that this bill would have gone a long way toward helping. We started to work on a remodel of our law enforcement center in a county that I was working in. And the remodel included a number of security measures that we had to get into place. And because it wasn't a strictly law enforcement operation, we were actually limited. Now, over the years, there have been many amendments to the public records and public meetings laws that have enabled that would enable a similarly situated local government to do a little bit better than we did about keeping things confidential. But at the time, we were forced in open session to discuss the security measures that we wanted to put in place in case of an attack on our law enforcement center, or the kind of architectural, structural safeguards that we were putting into the building, made it all seem rather useless to go through these exercises. When I look at the bill that's before you today, what it would do is to allow a government agency such as the one I work for now, or such as any other government agency in the state, to actually have measures in place without exposing the kind of confidentiality that's necessary to make them actually work. So if we needed to put security measures in place to guard a public or a utility but owned by a private organization, we would have that ability to do that under this particular bill. So a couple of other points I wanted to bring out, and just to tie this up quickly because I know there are a lot of people who want to testify, but One thing is, as Ms. Munson was describing, it is a balancing test on the amendments that would take place at 501, 18, 22, and 23. If the public interest requires disclosure, then the law is going to provide for that disclosure. And as someone who has actually been in court arguing on 501, I know that the law does require disclosure, sometimes even when I would have preferred that they didn't. So that is that's a very, very good safeguard, and the courts take it very seriously. The other thing I wanted to say is that non-disclosure is not mandatory. If the local government agency feels that this is the kind of information that should be put out to the public, we have the right to hold the meeting in an open forum rather than in an executive session. And at least in my city, I can say that we would do that if we seriously felt that there wasn't a need to protect the information that was going to be discussed. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Haynes.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom O'Connor. I represent Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Oregon Municipal, the 12 Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities are public agencies, so we are subject to the Public Records Act and Open Meetings Law. We very much support House Bill 2425 as a way of protecting the security plans of this critical infrastructure. At the same time, the bill does not affect the existing safety measures and other kinds of things that are in place and open to the public. Obviously, you're not going to hide a substation or an electricity line. But we do support the bill and urge its passage. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Are there questions for any member of this panel? We're a quiet group today.
Mr. Chair, I'm just waiting for the next shoe to drop.
It's coming. Yeah, okay. He's out in the hallway right now. but we'll get there in a minute. We're going to bring up now Gary Bauer, Shelley Jensen, and Dave Robertson. We just take it in the order I read them off. Are you prepared, Gary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Bauer, representing Northwest Natural. We are a local distribution company for natural gas here in Oregon and in southern Washington. We are an investor-owned utility that's regulated by the Public Utility Commission. And as a result, the PUC has some broad authority for safety of utility operations. And in addition, the Public Utility Commission also does some work on behalf of the U.S. Department of Transportation's Office of Pipeline Safety. So we have a very close working relationship with them regarding our system, the safety of the system, and then also on security issues. We would like the ability to continue to and work further with our regulators on these matters and in discussing security measures with them. We support House Bill 2425 as it was introduced. We support exempting documents from the public records law. We support being able to discuss security information in an executive session that only includes individuals that need to know about that security information. I did participate in the work group during the interim. They have not participated, I guess, since I just saw the amendments today and the changes on utility matters and how they would treat utility information in an executive session. Our general attitude is just that a security plan doesn't do us any good if it's available to people who don't have a need to know. There was a comment about the more eyes and ears would be involved by having certain types of executive sessions that are open to other individuals. And our view is that the value of our security plan declines dramatically with the amount of people that are involved in understanding and seeing that plan. With that, again, we're maybe a difference between us and some of the other folks that have been up here is we're not a public entity that is overseeing itself. We are private organizations that are working with a public entity, whether that's police and fire departments or with, in our case, our regulator, in trying to give them the opportunity to take a second look at what it is we're doing and feel comfortable with the actions we're taking. With that, thank you, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Again, we'll go to the panel before we open up for questions. Shelley Jensen, Verizon.
I'm Shelley Jensen. I'm Regulatory and Governmental Affairs Manager for Verizon. We are a local telephone company in Oregon. We serve primarily Washington, Clackamas, Multnomah counties, although we do have some rural areas as well. We are also the telephone company in New York City on September 11th, so our concerns about security and privacy of where our network is located have increased significantly since then. I would pretty much echo what Mr. Bauer has already said, that we're here to support the bill. We're more supportive of the original version than we are of the amendments, again, because of concerns about including folks who don't have a need to know in meetings, and particularly I was a little bit concerned after the last panel saying that they weren't required to have executive sessions, that anything they felt the public needed to know they could have an open session, and that would be of some concern to us as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Robertson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Robertson. I represent PG&E Gas Transmission Northwest. We're one of two main natural gas supply systems into the Pacific Northwest and the state of Oregon. Our pipeline goes north to south through the state, through the counties of Umatilla, Morrow, Gillum, Sherman, Jefferson, Deschutes, Klamath, and we cut over the Cascades to Jackson County as well. So we cover a lot of territory. Our main customers are customers like Northwest Natural in the Portland area that ships gas down our pipeline in eastern Oregon and then across the Columbia Gorge to its territory here in Northwest Oregon. We also serve Avista Utilities down in Medford and other electric generating plants in the state. I do echo the comments of Mr. Bauer regarding the latest draft. We were part of the working group last fall in the interim, but the latest draft was one we had not had a chance to see fully until today. So our concerns regarding executive session are the same as Mr. Bauer's. I think we're a federally regulated pipeline in a couple of ways. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission regulates us on economics and siting and our rate of return. The Federal Office of Pipeline Safety regulates us on safety and security. And so we have been working primarily with the Federal Office of Pipeline Safety since September 11th in setting up protocols for us to observe as the threat levels related to security increase. What we value is our, and what's critical to ensuring the security of these facilities is our ability to work with the feds, work with the PUC in the state of Oregon, work with local governments and first responders, and share information so that we all know where our critical facilities are and are able to protect those in the best way possible. I'll just leave it at that, and again, just we'd like to lend our support to 2425.
Great, thank you very much.
Welcome.
So, questions for this panel?
So, Mr.
Yes,
Chair,
Representative Anderson, then Representative Shetterly.
I take it from all three of you that you would prefer to see the documents and records kept from executive session, just secured. Without going to executive session. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gary Bauer. I think there's two to the extent I understand the public records law, there's kind of two ways to look at the executive session. There's the executive sessions in which the press are allowed into it, and then there's also an executive session in which no one's allowed in except for the, for example, ourselves. And there is a current statute treats the Energy Facility Siting Council and nuclear plant security information in the latter manner, where only those entities, those folks are in the room.
And which of that?
We prefer the latter, where basically only in the individual that the entity that has responsibility for the security of a facility and the regulator are in the meeting.
And that is where this law is going?
The original bill, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the original bill did that. The amendments that have just been proposed today would go to an executive session and allow the press to participate.
Can I follow that up?
You may.
More of a comment than a question at this point, that in several number of years in working with the city as mayor, I've noticed two situations where when the press was in, security was violated, and at that point nothing was done, although probably should have been. But the thing that concerns me more would be that when the press or anyone is allowed in, they then can easily use the information they've heard without exposing anything that was said within, ask questions that elucidate some of the material that was discussed in there. And I would be feeling kind of uncomfortable if we didn't have a real clamp on any of this high security information getting outside the room.
Representative Sherwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want a clarification. We obviously haven't seen any amendments. Have you participated in the formulation of these, even as far as being consulted, or are you just kind of waiting to see these two?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, we participated last fall in the formulation of the original bill. Of the latest round of amendments, we have not participated in that group.
Anything further for this panel? Okay, thank you. All right, Tom Gallagher and Jeb, and I'm going to get the last name wrong. Is it Blanding?
It's my handwriting, Mr. Chair. It's Mr. Bladeen.
Bladeen. Blame Mr. Gallagher for his poor handwriting.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jeb Bladeen. I'm a publisher of the News Register in McMinnville, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. ONPA basically agrees with the, in general and in almost all specifics, with the amendments that have been talked about today and in the Handen Gross bill that's been put in front of you. And we strongly support elements of those compared to the original bill. We have concerns about having major areas of discussion be completely exempted from the public meetings law and support those changes. If there's any concern left, and basically ONPA agrees with the intent of the need to protect basic certain information, we have some concerns about the possible misuse of language that might be put into either open records or open meetings law. For example, what's been referred to here today as "this just affects the utilities" is actually some very broad language. It does affect the big utilities and the big utility systems, but it also affects every level of security for every kind of imaginable communication, gasoline, any type of hazardous material for any school district, city, special district, county, or anybody else in Oregon. So the idea of taking all of that, putting it into 502 with an absolute exemption from public records, no balancing test for the public interest, and taking it completely out of application of the public meetings law just does not sit right with the newspaper members of our organization. So we strongly believe that that the amendments are better than the original bill, that the information should be in the area of executive session, not in the area of exempt from public meetings altogether. And one last thing would be to just ask that the task force take a look at the broad area of placing this information into 502 with absolutely no public interest balancing test. That is a concern of some of our members. The information that leads into that, the language is information about review or approval of. Very broad language. And to have no balancing test whatsoever is a concern to some of our members. There's two ways to have a balancing test. One way is to place this into 501, 192.501, where there is a balancing test for everything in that section of law. But another way is to actually place more restrictive balancing test language within 502. Such balancing languages exist in several provisions of 502, where the broad area does not have a general public balancing test, such as 501, but specific language could be written into it to have a more restrictive balancing test. With that one concern, as I said, we would generally favor the amendments that you've seen and heard. And with that, I'll end my testimony and be glad to answer any questions.
Mr. Gallagher, are you here to testify or just accompany?
Question.
Okay. I just was going to let...
Okay, let him go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I just have a couple additional comments to make. I'll talk specifically about the Tom Gallagher representing the Oregon newspaper publishers. Specifically about the executive session section, which seems to be the really only point of contention here. And I think most of Gary Bauer's remarks are on point, and I would agree with them. I would say, though, that on the FSEC statute, when that was put in originally, it was a very narrow section relating to the Energy Facility Siting Council review of one plant in Oregon. There may have been more, but there only been one at this point in time. And a nuclear power plant, which has lots of risks associated, not just to terrorism, but to all sorts of other things that are difficult security issues in those plants. This is much broader. This is water, telecommunications, this is local government, this is state government. It's not just one body. So that's why we think that the executive session application here, letting the press in, is important. Secondly, when the press goes to executive session, there are no documents available. There's general discussion and general conversation. The press doesn't get all the same information. Those documents are still secret. They don't have to pass them out to the press. The press sits in the back of the room, and they listen. If there is a lack of security, if the utility didn't do a good job and the oversight committee doesn't do a good job, this is the last chance anybody really has to know about it, is that reporter going out, finding a sources outside the executive session and reporting on that. The third thing I'd say is that, especially at the PUC, where the bulk of these documents are going to come in, there's almost never any press there. The executive sessions that they're going to talk about are the commission getting together to review some of the documents and so forth. That's not normally covered and probably wouldn't be covered in general reporting. Some of the local council meetings, where if the local council were to request the pipeline security document and the utility went in to explain it to the local city council, then I think that, you know, there's oftentimes a reporter covering that press and would be there. The last thing I'd say on executive session, and this is what occurred in the smaller group that meant that didn't have the utilities in it, because we were both basically talking about the other sections, but they weren't there, is that if this doesn't work, then we can come back and narrow the statute even more. If you narrow the statute right out the door and say, we're going to pitch not only the section into 502 where the document doesn't get disclosed, but we're going to keep the press out of any of the review of the public agency, we would have to come back without any examples of a way to change the statute. So we feel that starting out with a smaller step of putting it in 660 rather than 690 makes sense. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. I just had a question, and I probably should know this. I represent some public bodies, but thankfully I guess we've always gotten the public records issues resolved before it's gotten to a challenge. But between 501 and 502, one being the absolute and the other being the weighing of the public interest, I guess initially it's the public body that makes that public interest determination.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, there's a three-step process. The local body would make the decision. Somebody would request the document. Say it's a local body here, then it would be reviewed by their council. And if the council says exempted and the press still challenges it, it goes to the Marin County Circuit Court.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Marin County, that's if it's PUC. They don't all go to Marin County.
I think my rough recollection is, I read it this morning, is that they do, but that it may just be the state ones, but I think both do.
Yeah, I think local government actually goes to, they go to the DA's office, don't they make
the
determination?
District attorney's office. Oh, then to the court.
Then to court, yeah.
Right. Okay. That was my reference to counsel.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Are there further questions of the panel? Yes, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If there was going to be a situation where a local government or the PUC had gone into executive session, and there is a reporter there, and let's just suppose, for example, that a reporter does show up at a PUC meeting, and goes ahead and reports on some of the details, even though they might not get the actual backup material, but has listened to the discussion and does report on some of the details that could compromise the security of the plant that the utility or the body was in fact trying to protect. What would be the remedy? Because you have not only the situation that the confidence has been breached, but you also have now a plan that probably took weeks, months, maybe years to formulate that all of a sudden is out in the public eye. So what's the remedy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, in the worst-case scenario, irreparable harm. In most situations that I could think of, and most examples in my practical 25 years in experience, I'm not so sure that it is irreparable harm. It depends on what actually got reported, how or why the reporter did it. I mean, let's assume it was the true security plan, and they just published it on the front page of the Daily Bugle as an invitation to mayhem and mishap. I don't think that under the current law that you put that person in jail, but we would certainly be rushing back in here to change the statute, and I would not be up here saying let the press in. What would happen, Representative Crummell, if one of the members of the city council did the same thing? I don't know. Irreparable harm or whatever harm would occur from whatever level of breach that happened. I still think at some point in time that we all are responsible people doing a responsible job under, you know, more than just the law, under our obligations as a community.
If I could insert, though, Mr. Gallagher, if a member of the city council did that, the public has the ability to remove him from office the next time he's up for re-election or through the process of recall. I haven't seen any statutes through here lately allowing us to recall a newspaper short of canceling our subscription. So I'm not sure it's necessarily a comparable analogy.
In that case, Mr. Chair, I would agree. On the other hand, if a reporter and the newspaper and all of the people did that, I would suspect it wasn't a frolic and a detour, that this was some serious story or some serious problem that they were all reporting on. The Pentagon Papers comes to mind, other situations like that. Some would agree, some would disagree. But I don't think you can just lay out a scenario and said that a reporter on their own went out and published this, because they still have to go through a fairly responsible operation of the newspaper as an entity, et cetera, the counsel to the newspaper, the irreparable harm that would occur to the press. So I would agree that that scenario is possible. Other disasters like that are possible, and I hope we don't ever have any of them.
It's Bledin, right?
Bledin, yes.
Mr. Bledin, explain to me, and I've got the testimony here, but I guess I'm interested in, you've indicated that you're generally not opposed to the amendments to the bill as they've been sort of laid out here, but you have concerns about the very thing that I think the utility folks came up and testified about. Is that right? Because they sort of don't like some of the amendments is with respect to the executive session and the public disclosure. Can you help refine what it is you're most concerned about that these utilities in declaring something to be, you know, subject to this kind of protection from disclosure would cause a newspaper, other than just the natural skepticism that comes from, you know, doing that role as a reporter, which I'm not at all prejudging. But beyond that, are there specific things that you're worried about not being disclosed as a result of this option?
Mr. Chairman, to clarify, we agreed essentially with all of those amendments, including the one about executive session, which was the amendment of moving from 690 to 660, I believe.
Right.
The one concern I expressed is that whenever new language is put into 192.502, which is the sort of the absolute exemption and without a public balancing test, it is subject to misuse. It is subject to information all over the state for every public body. So while we share the concern about the big utilities and situations where something getting out could allow someone to cause huge mischief or calamity in a broad area, it also covers tiny pieces of information at every local level, potentially about gasoline stored behind the shed or in any of those types of forms. Well, we just have a general concern that it can be misread and misused. When people see it in 502 at the local level, people will read that as an absolute exemption. I'm sorry, this is what the law says. We can't give this to you. There's not even a public balancing test. So it was just it's sort of a side issue to all of these amendments. We agree with those amendments as an additional side issue. We might ask the task force to consider some language, if they leave that within 502, to consider some language that keeps it as an application to what they're trying to apply it to.
Mr. Chair, if I could further amplify on that, I think in part of the discussions among part of the group, we originally wanted to take out a 502 and put it in a 501. Again, a misdeveloped security plan would deserve to be reviewed. But we made the compromise in our own minds that we would leave all of those sections with fairly loose language on what is security related to those private utilities in 502. They're not subject now to public review. They're in the utility's possession. We never see them. We leave them in 502. We'll never will see them. When the oversight committee or the city council begins to review the issue, that's the last point in time the general public has to look at it. So we're not reviewing the utility. That's the job of the PUC, let's say. We're reviewing the PUC. We're watching the PUC to see if the public body is doing their job, and that when we're done with the whole thing, there is the kind of security there in the plan that everybody wanted to rely on. So that was the compromise. Leave it in 502, take it out of 690 and put it in 660.
Any questions? Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of following up on Representative Krummel's question, should a reporter violate the trust? And maybe instead of going through your newspaper, calls Lars Larson, goes on there and says, here's what they talked about in executive session. What is the sanction? There is no legal sanction I'm asking. I shouldn't say it. I'm making that statement. I mean it as a question. Is there a legal sanction for that reporter? The newspapers essentially wrote the public records laws to protect reporters and allow them to do their job. So I think that's, I believe that's kind of what
I need to put. Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, well, at our paper, that would be a former reporter and the former editor that was working with him. But the sanction is the same as if a member of the public, as Mr. Gallagher said. A member of the council or a member of the staff, and particularly in today's Internet world, can disseminate information to calamitous effect very easily, just as a reporter could. But so there isn't a legal sanction. You're right. It would be an employment sanction.
Thank you.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, but I think there's a practical sanction and that the governing body would have the authority, I think, not to invite that reporter back to an executive session.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Any else, colleagues? Yes, counsel.
Chair, members of the committee, we did have a task force put together during the interim. It has not officially met since the end of the interim session. I know we've heard a couple people mention the task force. Some people who were involved have been meeting informally, and I actually attended one meeting. So,
thank you for that clarification. You'll also note, colleagues, that not testifying, but testimony. Thank you very much, both.
Thank you.
Testimony has been passed out and has been received by the committee from the City of Portland, from OPUDA, the Oregon People's Utility District Association, and from the City of Eugene. So that information has been provided, and their testimony has been received by the committee. I believe we have one more witness, Jim Upshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Good afternoon. I am a faculty member at the University of Oregon Journalism School and a board member of the state chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists, which is the world's largest organization of working journalists, and its main emphasis is in watching for these sort of big picture questions to pop up having to do with the rights of the public to the information handled by public agencies, freedom of information, and, I might add, professionalism within journalism, an ongoing effort to keep people on the mark. Today with me, and not registered, but I'd like to ask your permission to bring them up just for a brief comment or two, if they can. I have two other state board members, including the president of the state board of the Society of Professional Journalists, Mr. Jim Mures, who is an editor of the Register Guard in Eugene. Also here is Tom Henderson, editor-in-chief of the Polk County Itemizer Observer.
We wouldn't hold that against either of them.
Okay, great. We have chairs if you don't mind sparing us the brief additional time. In general, while they're getting seated, we're here to, as always, add our voices to others that are looking out for the public interest as directly as possible in terms of every citizen's right to know what his or her government is doing. So, of course, you might argue we are biased against the closure of public records in a broad sense. But we also recognize we're in extraordinary circumstances, as has been stated here several times today. I believe I had to sign in and check off for or against, and I can't say that I or the Society of Professional Journalists is against this bill. The point is that we have asked and attempted to stay in the conversation because we believe it's important that we hold out certain minimums in terms of access for the public to meetings and records of all public agencies. Mr. Cutler mentioned earlier this is a simple bill, my ears immediately pricked up because I thought, well, gee, in terms of its implications all around the state, small towns and large, people affected, it's anything but simple, at least in its ramifications. So what's decided here by this committee, very frankly, could have dozens of consequences. Every day. Let me address a couple of quick comments that have been made by others, if I may, also. Mr. Williford of the State Police Organization said that his job, his agency's job, is to make sure there are no substantial or significant gaps in security, and I guess I liken that to our task to make sure there are no significant holes in exposure of important public documents and proceedings. I also respect what Ms. Munson said. She said she knows this situation is touchy. We all do. We're aware not only of the pressure and the criticism that public agencies take, including legislative committees, but we take a lot of criticism ourselves as a profession broadly. Today, if I had a single main thrust to make, I guess it would be that breadth is the problem, and that what we'd like to continue to push for, and the amendments we've seen do answer a good deal of this, is language that can be as narrow as possible in relating to security plans, that is, defining what must be kept out of public view from the government's perspective. And in addition, with the access through executive sessions, guaranteeing at least the set of the ears on everything that government does. I mentioned that SPJ is interested in professional standards. You know, we don't have a licensed press in this country, and our ability to have an independent set of eyes and ears on you would be obviously compromised by that process. Instead, we have a strong measure of sort of self-reinforcement of high standards of integrity in dealing with anyone, including public bodies. And so a couple of reactions quickly. If, as several people have raised, people were to violate confidences, including an executive session, there would be, of course, the ability to go back and change the law. But immediately there would be questions raised, permanent questions, I think, in many cases about the ethics and integrity of the journalists. You know, we don't break confidences. That's one of our rules. And, so we do have to weigh the public interest every day, but that's what we're there for. So in this situation, I think the argument is simply that, to the extent that all government and public interaction rests on a degree of trust, that journalists with a strong ethical core continue to have enough trust to be in executive sessions. Now, if my colleagues have any quick comments or if you have questions. Thank you.
My only comment that I would, as Tom Henderson, by the way, from the Society of Professional Journalists, members of the committee, my only comment along with Jim said is I believe there is a sanction for the violation of the executive session. We're all keenly aware in our profession of the danger of precedent. And if a reporter violates executive session, we know that the legislature and authorities will exclude us. And so we know that is sacrosanct in our profession, that one must obey executive session or we will all be excluded.
Hi, I'm James Mirez. I'm the president of the Society of Professional Journalists here in Oregon. I'm also the assistant city editor at the Register Guard. I've edited many stories of Representative Shetterly's. I used to be at the Gazette Times recently. My only concern also with the bill is that all the any amendments language be narrowly defined. I've been witness or heard of an instance where a reporter did violate the spirit of executive session. That reporter was uninvited, was banned from covering that body anymore. In my position as an editor, that reporter would probably also be pulled off that beat, would have a tough time trying to keep its job. I understand the spirit of this bill. My hometown is in you could see the World Trade Center from my hometown. I went back there. It's very sad. I know people that were affected by it. And I don't want anything like that to ever happen again. Whatever it takes, I'm all for. I just ask that any language, that try to prevent something like that again be very narrowly defined and very well thought out before it is passed into any legislation. Thank you. If you have any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I just want to acknowledge for the record that I'm not aware that the Polk County Itemizer Observer has ever violated any executive session obligation with regard to reporting. At least not since Mr. Henderson's been on there.
All right, pandering to your own press, Representative.
Is that a CYA?
I was going to pander down there, but he's not in my district anymore.
So Representative Ackerman, you want to comment on the Register Guard while we're at it?
Yes, I can. Yeah. Let me make that comment. I think that in all my experiences in executive session, I think one of the more remarkable things that occurs is sometimes the governing body gets off the point and gets out of executive session material. It's reporter that says you're on the record and puts us back in executive session. And I think that's a great service.
Anything further? Okay, thank you very much. I'm sorry, Representative.
Quickly, Mr. Chair, if I may, were one of you at this second meeting that occurred that the utilities were not invited to?
We were not represented there.
Okay. Thank you.
Was that it?
Thank
you. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2425. I would ask the participants to communicate with Mr. Taylor on the issues of the final version of the amendments. It would be the committee's preference to address this issue in a relatively expeditious time frame, but we want to give the parties who spoke today a chance to get together and work on it.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I would like to request also, if I may, in this particular instance, if whenever amendments are prepared and ready, if we could get Ann's hand and gross version is very helpful, and if we could get that ahead of time before we consider the bill again, that would be most helpful.
To the extent that we have the time and resources, Representative Carmel, we'll do what we can to accommodate your request.
Thank you.
Committee, while we're still here and we have a quorum, we have several more bills that have been brought to us in the last hour and a half for introduction purposes. I have LC 1570 relating to planned unit development.
LC-2234 relating to health insurance surcharges for professional medical liability coverage, appropriating money and providing for revenue raising that requires approval by a three-fifths majority, 2616 relating to crime, 2783 relating to corrections, 2867 relating to controlled substances, and 3420 relating to health care dispute resolution. The chair would move introduction of all those bills as committee bills with all the appropriate provisos and limitations. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Those bills will be adopted as committee bills. Again, committee, we think there may still be a few more bills coming in. The office will call and try to reach you to establish a quorum at 4:30 if we need to. So I'm not going to adjourn, but simply recess the Judiciary Committee until 4:30 this afternoon. Thank you.
I'm not saying you want us back.
That's not right.
No, we'll call you and tell you.
Otherwise,